So please enjoy your breathing for a few moments. So in listening to the Dharma talk, your mind is relaxed, open, present. It is called learning to dwell happily in the present moment. A practice that seems so simple and yet it is so profound. As a culture, we seem to have lost our ability, that natural ability that young children have to dwell happily in the present moment. We think we need things to be happy. And actually, many times the things we have and the involvements we have and the relationships we have and the work we have often become sources of unhappiness. So to learn that each of us, just as we are, no matter what's going on in our life, have this capacity to stop, to come back to our body breath, to just be mindful and aware and relaxed. And wherever we are, whatever's going on in the external world, that we have this capacity. Please think about that. And if it sounds good to you, you might think of wanting to cultivate it. So welcome everyone. Seem to be a number of empty cushions here this morning, but I don't know if everyone knows, Thich Nhat Hanh is currently in this country, and he's actually this week giving a retreat in at his monastery practice center in Mississippi, and I think there are about 20 members who are there from our community who are there in at this retreat with in Mississippi. Of course, there are probably at least 800 or 1,000 others. We had a very nice day of mindfulness yesterday here, full day of mindfulness. Is there anybody who is new today? Just this is the first time they stumbled in? Oh, okay. Any questions you have about what we've done or seen? Everything kind of clear? I mean, good. So before we begin with the talk this morning, usually I like to begin with just an opportunity for anybody, if anybody has questions about the practice of meditation, mindfulness, and even more important, how we bring these practices and teachings into our daily life to affect healing and transformation, please feel free to ask a question if you have one. Yes.
cover.
Uh-huh.
So we didn't have time to cover.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. This is a question you asked.
Question.
Oh, okay, okay.
And my question was about, and we'll define it a little more by saying specifically for American Buddhists
in this day.
If thinking about non-attachment and impermanence, why would two people who love each other choose
to marry with a vow of till death do us part? Mm-hmm. There is non-permanent and non-attachment. So the question is, if Buddhists make such a big deal about impermanence and therefore non-attachment because of impermanence, you know, why would anybody, you know, why get married? I mean, why and make vows of commitment, such as to a death do us part? That's a good question. Again, please understand that, and we'll just, you know, I mean, I want to go to the heart of your question, but Buddhism has really nothing to say about marriage. Traditionally, in Asian countries where Buddhism developed, customs of marriage or relationship were governed by kind of cultural norms that predated Buddhism, right? And because in Asian Buddhism, the engine of it was very much a monastic, you know, doesn't mean that the majority of people were not lay people, but because of the nature that of a celibate monastic at the center of Asian Buddhism, obviously celibate monks and nuns, you know, are involved in marriage and long-term relationships. So usually customs of marriage were not governed by Buddhist teachings. On the other hand, teachings about love and relationship and things like that certainly were. Vows of to death do us, unto death, or death do us part, is a particular vernacular that's developed here in the West. My experience of marriage rituals in Asia, they're much more relaxed, which is interesting. And again, I mean, we have to realize that marriage is also illegal. You know, has a lot of legalities around it, and property, and how people share property and children. So, I mean, there's lots of that involved too, right? But having said that, I think the more interesting question is really what this points to. You know, if you know, and what we're talking about is everything changes, right? Everything's impermanent. This is kind of one of these fundamental teachings of Dharma, you know, and it's obvious to anybody. I mean, everything is changing. This is not just human history. This is not just epics. This is physical. This is biological. This is physics. everything, and this is psychological. I mean, mind states, emotions, thoughts, beliefs. Everything is constantly changing, right? I mean, you sit here in meditation and you watch your mind, and have you noticed that it changes? Yeah, constantly changing. Thoughts constantly coming and going, moods constantly coming, sensations coming, and it just goes, you know, from the time we go up, time that we go to bed, right? And everything is characterized by this change. Everything is constantly changing, right? And this is one of the, you know, the prime kind of fundamentals, you know, that the Buddha made central, you know, that we have to acknowledge this, that nothing is permanent. Nothing is really inherently solid, right? Everything is in flux. Everything is made up of everything else. Everything is interconnected. It's just endless variables, right? All kind of manifesting briefly. I mean, like right now, here we are. Right? even this coming together of this group of people is impermanent, right? I mean, we'll all go our separate ways. We may come back, we may not come back, you know, right? It's so that is the nature of things, right? And we know that people who make all kinds of commitments and vows don't follow through on them. I mean, not just only marriage vows, right? I mean, people, I mean, all of us here make commitments, you know, I'm going to exercise this, and I'm going to stop eating that, and I'm going to be nicer to this, you know, every New Year's people, you know what I mean? And yet we continue doing the same thing we've always done for many of us, right? So we know that even when we make commitments, right, that oftentimes our capacity to follow through with them may not always, you know, be consistent. Things do not often turn out the way we want, right? Friends become enemies, enemies become friends. People that we think is a source of great love and happiness to us become a source of suffering, right? We all know that. So, this is the dilemma, okay? In Buddhism, you see two fundamental responses, okay? One is, as I said, is the monastic response, right? Which would be what? Whew. I don't want anything to do with this, right? You see? It's called the path of renunciation, right? Yeah, I don't want anything to do with this, you know? No relationship, I'm not going to have relationships, I'm not going to have a job, I'm going to go off and live, you know, in a kind of nice little separate universe, where everything is held communally, you know what I'm saying? I just have a couple of robes and I shave my head. I don't have to deal with any of that stuff. It's all impermanent. It's all potentially a source of suffering, right? So I want to separate myself from, I want to renounce it. So that's one kind of traditional response. But then there's another response, which is, you know, all of us. We're lay people, aren't we? We live in the world of what? Of relationships, right? We choose to live in the midst of this world of change, of instability, right? And we choose to live with these things that are impermanent and are always changing, and to make our living in this world, you know, to create our relationships in this world, to find peace and happiness in this world, right? Yeah. So our path is not renunciation. Our path is understanding and compassion. Okay. So, you know, if one meets someone and one loves that person, right, as you asked, Laura, and they think, at this moment, it seems like this is a nice person I'd like to spend my rest of my life with, right? Okay. So what Buddhism has to offer that person, knowing impermanence, knowing that things change, people change, individual change, circumstances change, physical circumstances change, is the capacity to deal with that in a compassionate way, in a wise way, in a loving way, in a patient way. Understanding that things will change. How do we deal with the change? How do we understand the change? How do we respond to the change? So, I mean, I think teachings that we are given from this tradition are incredibly beneficial for people in relationship. Because it really points to the reality that things are not as they seem, right? People are composed of many, 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 many causes and conditions and variables, and even when they say this, they may do that. Right? That's just the way it is, isn't it? And that even though we are hoping that this will last forever and that will last forever and people will always be the way we want them to be and jobs we like will always stay with us and, you know, people, and we know that's not true. So that is why the teaching of non-attachment is so important. And again, as I can't remember the conversation 2 weeks ago, but we have to understand that non-attachment does not mean detachment. That earlier renunciation monastic response is detachment. One detaches, one separates from. Obviously, if that's where one's at, getting into a relationship would probably not be the best course of action. Right? I mean, who wants to get in relationship to somebody who's detached from you? Right? It'd be kind of painful, wouldn't it? No. So the issue for all of us, whether it's personal relations, intimate relationships, work relationships, is how can we enter this world? And again, our life is a world of endless relationships, right? We are relating to everything. Right now, we're relating to each other here. But we can relate to each other wisely. With no attachment means I want to hold on to us. I want to stay attached to it. I want it to stay the way it is. I want it always to be the way it, right? That's attachment. And to be attached to something that is changing is going to lead to what? Suffering. Right? That is why in Buddhism, attachment is seen as a fundamental source of human suffering. Again, non-attachment, you know, if you have attachment here and detachment here, non-attachment's kind of here, right? It's a way to be in the world of relationships, to be in the world of things, but because of one's understanding of impermanence, because of one's understanding of the nature that nothing is solid or, you know, everything is in a process of changing and transformation, one can live in this world of change and not be, not have it be a cause of suffering, or at least minimize the level of suffering, because one understands this is just the way it is. This is the way people are. How are people? They're a mess. Have you noticed that? Yeah. I mean, it's this world's a mess. People are a mess. We're a mess, right? And yet, in it, in this mess, there are ways of living, ways of understanding that can help us kind of minimize the damage and maximize the happiness and well-being. And that's what a good way, a Dharma way, a Buddhism way, or other kinds of ways, at least, I mean, I'm just a Buddhist teacher, so I just talk about this way. I mean, that's what it's here for. Right? It's not something to practice over here separate from our life. It's something to practice in life so we can live in this world of change and disappointment, and, you know what I mean, and not be thrown by it. Right? Not be on an emotional roller coaster. Right? So, the capacity to have a deep understanding of the nature of things and the nature of people, and the capacity to generate compassion and loving kindness, which is what? That you know that so many people who do the things they do, including ourselves, we do it and they do it because why? Because they're ignorant. Or because they suffer. Right? And when you combine those two, watch out. Right? So when someone is really ignorant of the way things are and ignorant of the effects of their actions, right, and are blinded by their own suffering, their own emotionality, watch out. We need to watch out for them, but we need to watch out when we're in that state. Because if we're not careful, we will create suffering for others, even though we don't want to. And again, in terms of relationships and things like marriage and all that, we're in a very difficult time. Up to very recently, customs of marriage and relationships were very delineated. You do this, you don't do that. Right? And whether you're, you know, whether you're happy or not, this is unto death, right? So it was very kind of black and white, and then most of the society bought into it. But you know, these days that's not the case in most. And so it's really a very difficult time. I think that's why people are struggling very much in relationships, because those traditional rules and customs are no longer operating. And the expectations that people have and bring to their relationships are very different than a generation or two ago. Much higher expectations. So that's why I think it's important. I mean, many people say, you know, well, how come, you know, when they read Buddha's teachings or Buddhism, they say, well, how come these masters never talk about relationships? And again, it's not because Buddhism doesn't have anything relevant to say about it. It's again because it really wasn't in the purview of Buddha's teachings. Because again, relationships were very informed by just social custom. But if you are paying attention to what goes on politically these days, you know. A kind of unified sense of social custom seems to be quickly evaporating in our country. So, difficult. Any other questions? Oh. any other questions? As some of you who come regularly know, beginning October 1st, and October 1st is just in a couple of days, Tuesday, we are beginning in our community what we call these paths of awakening. This is kind of a general theme that we will be kind of informing our practice, the Dharma talks, and the retreats and intensives over the next 6 to 8 months. This one that is beginning in 2 days is called Mastering the Fundamentals. And the idea here is, for those of you who are new to our community, we have a lot that goes on here. I mean, beside these types of Dharma talks on a weekly basis, we have these intensive periods of practice, of study and meditation for 3 to 6 months that have on specific themes. We have retreats and all these kinds of activities. But lately, as our community has grown, we've tried to be more systematic so people understand what we're doing. And so we've developed, and you can go to our website, these kinds of levels of practice, 3 levels of practice, and I won't go into them now. Again, you can read about them at some length on the website. But the first two are called, the first one is called the Path of Mindful Living, and the second one is called the Dharma Path. And so what we are beginning in this October is to spend 3 months very focused on the basics of mindfulness. And I've invited our community, both those people who are new and those people who have been practicing for 10, 15 years, to practice the fundamentals together. The fundamentals of mindfulness, the fundamentals of living in the present moment, and so the talks over these next couple of months will be coming from that, as well as that we have an intensive, and we have close to 80 people in this intensive, and to be in an intensive in our community means that one has kind of made several commitments, such as practicing at least 1 hour a day, attending all the meetings of the community. There'll be special readings coming from the Buddhist tradition and the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition on mindfulness and mindfulness of the body and breath and mind, the Satipatthana Sutra, and the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh on mindful living. There'll be a retreat in October dealing with this. So that's kind of the theme for these next 3 months, will be on mastering the fundamentals of mindfulness. learning to live in the present moment. Something, as you might have noticed, is much easier said than done. Right, we had people at the Day of Mindfulness, we had a lot of interchange yesterday, and people were noting that even though they talk a good game, yet they really, were, if they're honest with themselves, find that they spend very little time during their day present, living mindfully. So we want to begin to look more deeply into that as a community. So that is what we'll be up to, and I just wanted to acknowledge that. But since this is the last little talk before we begin, you know, for the last 6 weeks or so, well, probably not, maybe this is my third talk on it, but I just wanted to finish up. You know, we were reading this wonderful, and I believe the talks are all on the website, this wonderful poem called Advice from Me to Myself by Patro Rinpoche, a Tibetan, great Tibetan teacher in the 19th century. This is a, goes on for 4 pages. It's all in verse. For those who've been here for a while or heard it, it begins, "Listen up, all bad karma patrol, you dweller in distraction." So this is a kind of a letter of advice that he writes to himself, obviously to inspire him. And it's quite insightful all the way through. And I'm just going to skip. And again, you can if you're interested, you can find more information about this on the website or on the web, called Patro Rinpoche, Advice from Me to Myself. I want to skip, just for the sake of time, to the very last line. But I encourage you all to look at the prior lines. And his last line reads, "If you let go of everything, 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 that's the real point." Let me read that again. If you let go of everything, 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 that's the real point. He's got a little exclamation point there. And then there's a little, at the end, it's very traditional to write a little colophon of kind of about the topic. And he says, "This advice," this is after his poem is done, "this advice was written by the practitioner Patro Rinpoche for his intimate friend Patro Rinpoche in order to give advice that is tailored exactly to his capacities. This advice should be put into practice." And then he says, "Even though you don't know how to practice, just let go of everything. That's what I really want to say." And then he adds, "Even though you aren't able to succeed in your Dharma practice, don't get angry." Quite wonderful. Yesterday, a lot of the theme of our Day of Mindfulness was on reflection. In Buddhism, going back to the Buddha, there was that little model that said, hear the teachings, reflect on the teachings, practice the teachings. Maybe some of you who are familiar with Buddhism have heard this. Unfortunately, I think what goes on these days is people hear the teachings or read the teachings, and then they practice the teachings. But they never really deeply reflect on the teachings. And it's because of that lack of reflection, which means real chewing on, digesting, you know, do I really believe this? Does this really make sense to me? Do I really want to practice this? You know, that kind of using this marvelous tool of the mind and its capacities to reflect, to observe, to understand. We often don't use that. And so, again, like he just said, this advice should be put into practice. But if we don't really think about the advice that we're being given, you know, the problem is many of us, you know, when we do these intensives and they're assigned their readings, what I often say to people is, you have to be very careful. You should not read these texts like you read a novel. You know, how do we read a novel? We just read. You know what I mean? Close the book, right? These teachings are meant to transform us, to change us. So they have to be, you know, we should read a sentence. We should at the most read a paragraph. And then we should stop, right? And ask ourselves, you know, what is this writer saying? Right? What's he saying here? What does he mean? Why is he saying this? And what do I really think about what he's saying? Do I think it's true? Right? Do I think it's accurate? Do I think it's meaningful? And if that's the case, do I want to take this into my life? And how do I want to take it into my life? And what are the implications if I do take it into my life? Can you see there's a process? To me, it's analogous of, you know, when we put food in our mouth, we have to chew it if we want it to be digested. Right? So these teachings, whatever teachings you're engaged in, they should be reflected on, so they really understand and the meaning's extracted, and then we should say, oh, yeah, I get it. Yeah. Right? I want to be in relationship to somebody, and yet I know everything's impermanent. Right? Do I get it before I start? And even though this person's expressing the most wonderful intentions for ever and ever, is everybody really these days capable of really fulfilling that? Does everybody really know themselves? Right. So, you know, it's like you want to think, reflect deeply before you buy in. And then when the buy-in is what? Is practice. All right. I buy into this. Right. As somebody said yesterday who's been practicing 20 years, she said, you know what? I realize, even though I've read endless books on mindfulness, I've been to endless talks, retreats, and I do practice it, you know, in my daily meditation, I really don't live mindfully, and I've been at this 20 years. And she said, maybe it's because I really don't see the payoff. It was interesting. That was her exact word. I don't see the payoff. And I said, you're right. There's got to be, you know, you're not going to undertake anything that you don't get immediate, you know, I mean, we are such a society in which we want immediate payoff, right? I want to feel good, I'll just take something. Immediate payoff. Right? That's why we, you know, all the things we do that are so short-term to give ourselves some sense of happiness, some sense of meaning, some sense of something, you know, consume, because it gives us immediate, right? Immediate gratification, right? There's an immediate payoff. Of course, after you've done that for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, you realize there's a downside to living in the world of immediate payoff, because there's really, there's a downside to all that, right? But if you're going to undertake a way of living that will give you some immediate payoff, but really the payoff is a little more down the line, because it's something you have to work at. Something that you have to be a little disciplined. And discipline is what? Sometimes tedious, sometimes frustrating, sometimes boring, right? But when you've bought into the payoff, you're willing to go through it. You're willing to put up with it, right? There's a light at the end of the tunnel. And whether that's school, whether that's a relationship, whether that's a craft, a skill, a sport, right? a musical instrument, right? We know that's true. Well, this is the same, right? So one has to know that. So that's what he's saying. So we put it into practice. If you let go of everything, that's the real point. The real point of what? The real point of a spiritual life, of a Dharma life. Most of us, I mean, first of all, has anybody ever heard the expression letting go? Right? Yeah, everybody talks about letting go these days, right? I gotta let go. I mean, people will tell you that. I know I gotta let go. Right? Well, why don't you let go? It's like, well, I'm not ready. Right? I know I gotta let go, but I'm not ready. So there is a common belief in our society, at a certain level of culture, that letting go, right, is good. And that the source of so much of our suffering is because we are what? Holding on. We are holding on to something we should let go of. Does that sound familiar? Now, why do we hold on to things that we know are causes of suffering to us? Anybody want to posit a guess? Right? Why do we hold on to things that we know, when we are rational or objective, that this is a source of suffering to me, and we'll even say, I know I need to let go? We think we're, all right, so you think there's a, for some, maybe it's a kind of conditioning, you're supposed to hold on to the bitter end. Never give up. Yeah. Any other reason? Well, then we're really sick. But you're, so, but we're saying that, yes, the payoff of holding on and suffering is a better payoff than
perceived.
So, right. So that's called ignorance, right? Yeah, that's good. So because we're ignorant, right? Again, Buddhism in Buddhism, ignorance is a very big term. It does imply stupidity, which is hard for us to say about ourselves. Stupidity means what? Stupidity means what? You know it's wrong, but we're stupid. Right? I mean, I used to know people who smoke cigarettes say, I know this is bad for me. Yeah, I know this causes cancer. What do you call that? Stupid. You mean, do they say that to themselves?
Yeah.
Well, we know.
They really look at what's cancer.
Well, I think you've answered the question. I mean, we know there are other kind of psychological things like denial and all these things and rationalization. But I'm, you know, just. But the bottom line is what? We involve ourselves in endless type of activities, mind states, etc., that when we are objective, when we can step back, or maybe when we see somebody else doing it, we will say what? That is a source of suffering. That way of living is not good for my body. I am imbibing things that are toxic, harmful to my body. I am involving myself in mind states and emotional states that are toxic for my body and for those I love and care about. Right? And yet what? We continue on. Why do we continue on? We are attached. We're attached. So this is very simple. We might say this is not very sophisticated. Because he's giving us a one word answer. to our suffering. We are holding on to something we should let go of. Try not to suffer and hold on. Holding on is the suffering. Whether we're holding on to an image, a thought, a perception, a desire, a need, a want, an expectation, there's always something we are holding on to that we need to let go of if we want to stop suffering. Yes?
A good image is like let go of cigarettes or doing something wrong. A good image would be one of those people on the TV commercials that had cancer that have to open the trim to have tubes going through their trim. They're talking to little tubes and little voice boxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hold on to, you know, if you have to replay. The image of what holding on can do can be stronger than the image of letting go.
One has to be able to see that the holding on is a cause of suffering. Think about right now all the areas in your life that you suffer and ask yourself, what am I holding on to? People suffer because they don't like what they see in the mirror, right? Aging is a big cause of suffering to people these days. What are they holding on to? Yeah, or the way they were, or they wanted, the way they want to be, right? Holding on. If you let go of that expectation of how you should be or shouldn't be, or what's right or wrong, then you're what? You're not suffering. People often say when somebody does or acts in a certain way, they say things like, I can't believe they did that. You ever hear anybody say things like that? I can't believe they did that. But the truth is what? They just did it. The reason you say, I can't believe it, is because you are holding on to some fantasy about how things should be, or how that person should be, or how things should happen. I mean, we say it all the time about the news. I can't believe that somebody just killed a bunch of people, right? Killed a bunch of children. What are we holding on to? And that holding on prevents us to see the truth. Like you said, about smoking. If you don't hold on to some false belief about that it's really not that harmful, or it's really not that, but really see it for what it is, you might let it go. And in our world today, we have to stop saying, I can't believe this, because it is all happening, isn't it? And it's happening because of causes and conditions. And things will only change when we change the causes and conditions. If you let go of everything, how do you think you'd be if you let go of everything? Again, this is not detachment. This is non-attachment. If you let go of everything, which means you let go of all your expectations about how you should be, how life should be, how people should be, how they should treat you, how they shouldn't treat you, what's, you know, if you let go of it all, how your life should turn out for you, how things should be, how, you know, if you let go of all of that, what would you be left with?
Openness.
What?
Openness.
openness, acceptance,
free,
peaceful. What?
Flexible,
yeah. Curious, yeah. Well, I don't know anything. You know, why is this going on? What's happening? Why did this person do this? Why are they acting like this? You know, why do people shoot other people? You know, why? What's, you know, we look deeply. Even though you don't know how to practice, just let go of everything. That's what I really want to say. This is really wonderful, right? Because many of us think, well, I got to become a good meditator, and, you know, I can't really ever be happy or lead a decent life unless I become a good meditator and really develop really, you know, really precise mindfulness throughout the day, and, right? He goes all around that. What does he say? Even though you don't know how to practice, just let go of everything. That's what I want to say. What wonderful advice. So we need to look deeply at to really what really binds us, what really causes us to suffer, to be unhappy. And what causes us to bring that kind of unhappiness, conflict, etc., to others, even those we love? It is because there is something we are holding on to, something we don't want to be. Some, you know, why do we control and manipulate other people? Why? Because we think if we let go and let them be who they are, then what? What? We'll lose them, or they won't be the way that we don't treat, you know, it's like, so we control and manipulate, which only causes what? Suffering, unhappiness, conflict. So, even though you don't know how to practice, just let go of everything. That's what I really want to say. Even though you aren't able to succeed in your Dharma practice, don't get angry. Anger, I think he's really saying, don't get frustrated. You know, don't get frustrated. Again, you only get frustrated in your meditation, mindfulness, Dharma, spiritual practice, whatever it is. You get frustrated because why? Because again, you have an expectation of how you're supposed to be. Right? I'm supposed to be able to sit down and just have a very concentrated, clear mind and be at peace and have wonderful feelings and be happy, and right? And I'm frustrated because it's not working that way. Many people who get into meditative life are very disappointed with themselves, right? I should be different than I am. Unfortunately, what? What's the truth? We are who we are. And that person who sits on the meditation mat with us is that same, you know, that same person. Can't get rid of them. So rather than being disappointed, frustrated, angry with ourselves for not being the way we think we should be, we need to learn what? To let go, to be understanding, to be compassionate, and to learn to work in a wise, intelligent, compassionate way with this person to help them heal and transform, to help them learn to be happy, to help them learn to be a little more mindful, a little more present, a little more concentrated. So what do you think about if you let go of everything, 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 that's the real point. That's what I really want to say. I mean, is everybody 100% committed? Let me ask you first thing. Does it logically make sense to you? Is anybody who doesn't logically make sense that somehow there's a direct relationship with their suffering and unhappiness and they're holding on to something? Steve, always the man to take the contrary position. Good.
So it makes sense, but you say something about how you balance that. The other piece of it that's still helpful is like a discipline before, right? You have to have. You see, like I'm thinking about myself. I see patterns. There's some patterns I can recognize that lead to suffering over and over again. And one of the things that seems important precisely to develop a discipline for some of those things to stop. And so, like how, I mean, if they have to go together, be able to let go in some way.
No. But it's interesting. This is holding on. Right? Now I can be holding on just like that, or I can be really holding on, right? White knuckling it. Can you see? That's holding on. Okay? You're watching very carefully. How hard is that? How hard is letting go? Letting go is just letting go. You look and you see all the places you're holding on, all the places where you're stuck, all the places because you're trying to control, manipulate yourself or somebody else or some situation, right? Something you won't accept. Right? I just won't accept this. Right? Damn it, I just won't accept it. And yet the truth is what? It's what's happening, or it's already happened, right? And we just need to go. And we just need to let go. When you let go, you see now, I can pick it up again, can I? Okay? And I can use it, right? To help drink my tea, right? And I understand what it is. But if circumstances arise that I need to let go of it, I can let go of it. Or if it disappears on its own, if it breaks, somebody steals it. If I'm not attached, I can be okay with that. I may not be happy, I mean I liked it, but it's not devastating. Many of us live in a world where loss is devastating. Change is devastating. Rather than just something that happens. Happens to who? Happens to everybody. You know, we just, to be honest with us, we just get bothered when it happens to us. I mean, we are kind of selfish. I mean, most of the things that upset us are happening to people all over the world, all the time. But then when they happen to us, we go, what? This is not fair. Right? I mean, like when it was happening to everybody else, we couldn't give a damn. But now when it happens to us. And I say that not to be negative, but just to see how, in a certain sense, we are just in our own little bubbles, right? Yes.
I can see how there are certain things that are simple to let go of, but then there's a lot of things like if you're trauma or depression or that you just can't just let go of.
Such as? Give me an example. I don't know anything. I'm here to learn.
I'm sorry to say that. Somebody who's been severely abused.
Okay.
They can't just choose to let go of the PTSD symptoms that they have.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, it's not, it's a little more subtle than I made it out to be. But I would say the same principle is holding on, right? If someone has had significant trauma in their past, and even though we know there are unconscious processes that occur in the body and in the mind from trauma that take working on, but a lot of times the trauma is related to something that happened in the past. And the fact that it happened to, let's say, me, is something that I can't accept. It's painful. It shouldn't have happened. Or I've developed all kinds of ideas about myself or my worthiness, or, you know what I mean, all kinds of, right? But I don't have to, do I? Because, you know, it's interesting. This is another one of these little things we say all the time. We say what? We say the past is past, don't we? Everybody knows that, right? The past is past, the future hasn't come. But what does that mean? That means the past does not exist. It is gone. All we have is this present moment. So my childhood, whether it was a wonderful childhood or a terrible childhood, is gone. It no longer is active in my life. It happened years ago. It exists how? As memories. Do I choose to hold on to those memories? Dwell on those memories? Ruminate on those memories? Define myself by those memories? Live from those memories? See myself through those memories? Or do I understand that this moment right now is fresh? Right? What is your name?
Rebecca.
So Rebecca, let's say you had a wonderful childhood, okay? And let's say I had a horrific childhood. Here we are right now, okay? You're looking at me, I'm looking at you. You can be aware of me and your body and sitting here. I can do the same, right? I can do my best to be totally present to you, and my practice is to be mindful and to generate understanding and compassion. Can I do that even though I had this kind of childhood and you had that kind of childhood? Yeah. When you know that, and most people don't know that, most people live in the world of unconsciousness. The world of unconsciousness means we dwell in the world where we think that our conditioning is who we are. But when we understand that's not true, it's partially true. Our conditioning has got us to where I am right now. But I can be different in this moment. We know that, right? We know that people coming out of the same circumstances, exactly. Some people just act out continually, and some people change, don't they? All of a sudden they get a sense of a different possibility for themselves, a different way of acting, of being. So there is conditioning. And like you say, we understand from our lots of understanding about the nature of trauma that a lot of the conditioning is much more significant than other kinds of conditioning, much deeper. And effects are much more terrible on a human being. But at the same time, we have to understand that in the present, you know, through the various kinds of practices that we have of mindfulness, of looking deeply, of understanding, compassion, you know, things can change significantly. And that's our freedom. You know, even in the time of the Buddha, you know, there's a great anecdote with the Buddha with, Angulimala. You know, he was a serial killer. He was this guy who was a disciple of some kind of black magician or something, you know. He was basically told that if he got a necklace of, 100 fingers or something, you know, from all his thing, when he got to be the 100th, he would have some kind of great power, kind of magical power. So he was not a very good human being. And guess who his 100th finger was? The Buddha. And he started chasing the Buddha down one day. Anyhow, it's an interesting anecdote. You may be interested in reading about it. But anyhow, the Buddha stopped him in his tracks. And he became actually a disciple of the Buddha's. It's very interesting. Again, up to then, he'd really been a murderer. So he became a disciple of the Buddha, and very devoted, because the Buddha really gave him the opportunity to transform. An interesting thing would happen, though. You know, in those days, the disciples of the Buddha would go into villages to beg. They didn't have any food stores. You know, they were wanderers. And so Angulimala would, now he's a monk, right? He's a Buddha, he's followed the Buddha. And he's a monk, and he would go into these villages where they knew him as what? As this murderer. And when they see him, they would get furious, and they would beat him. And when that happened, the Buddha just said, you know, in the past you did these terrible deeds, and this is just part of what you have to bear. But if you keep, an even mind and an open mind and generate compassion and understanding, everything will be fine. And supposedly he became a fairly developed disciple of the Buddha. Right? So, again, I mean, we know in our own day and age, there are many people who come out of quite horrific circumstances and childhoods. And go through all kinds of terrible things, drugs, alcohol, crime, you know, all kinds of things. And some people what? Turn it around. It's kind of wonderful. So that potential for transformation, people who continue to see themselves as bad and no good or rotten or this and that and broken, and they won't change. They have to let go. One of the biggest things we have to let go is of our thoughts and our beliefs about ourselves and life. That's a big one. Let go. Right? That maybe our thoughts about ourselves and life are not correct. So anyhow, some wonderful teachings by Pachu Rinpoche, encouraging us to let go of everything. Please do your best.